Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again.
And welcome back, and it is now or never. That debt is fraud, and it is all about focusing on full compliance with the Constitution. No cherry picking. Even though you may have a favorite amendment or clause, we have to support the entire Constitution and demand full compliance to it. That's the secret right there, folks, because accountability to one's oath is where we begin taking the government back. Going through and understanding the Constitution, how it evolved, and we're literally in the Constitutional Convention where we're actually watching this thing starting to take form. And how we're watching this transformation of what seemed to be, in the original opinion, the creation of an aristocracy, more into a government representing the sovereigns of our society. So with that, welcome back, Sean. Great to have you back.
Good, sir.
And we kind of left with a portion of Madison's comments not covered. And so bottom line, I'll go ahead and finish reading that because that's what Tammy was doing. But unfortunately, we couldn't get it all in. But, you know, I was surprised that we got all of that that she did cover in the 6-7 minutes. So anyway, he ends his comment with this. In a Republican government, the majority, if united, have always an opportunity. The only remedy is to enlarge the sphere and thereby divide the community into so great a number of interests and parties that in the first place, a majority will not be likely at the same moment to have a common interest separate from that of the whole or of the minority. And in the second place, that in case they should have such an interest, they may not be apt to unite in the pursuit of it. It was incumbent on us then to try this remedy, and with that view to frame a Republican system on such a scale, in such a form, as will control all the evils which have been experienced. Now, one of the things that he used before, that he, you know, used this term called color. And I'm not sure, because not a lot of people have heard. Do you know what that reference or color means?
Not exactly.
So the term color, like the color of law, C-O-L-O-U-R, the color of law is law that is made that is not legitimate. It's basically pretended law. And so when he talks about this color, when they talk about the color of government, they're talking about non-legitimate government, government that has been pretended or doing things that they don't have the authority to do. So with that, you know, they use that term, and they've seen that, and it's an old term, but in today, every once in a while, you'll actually hear people use that term. Oh, well, that's the color of law. And most people don't understand the context of that. So I just wanted to make sure that when you do hear people use that word color, then they're literally referring to the pretense of law. Okay, so Mr. Dickinson then decides to opine. So let's go ahead and pick up what he said.
Considered it as essential that one branch of the legislature should be drawn immediately from the people, and as expedient that the other should be chosen by the legislatures of the states. This combination of the state's governance with the national government was as politic as it was unavoidable. In the formation of the Senate, we ought to carry it through such a refining process as it will assimilate it as near as may be to the House of Lords in England. He repeated his warm eulogiums on the British Constitution. He was for a strong national government, but for leaving the states a considerable agency in the system. The objection against making the former dependent on the latter might be obviated by giving to the Senate an authority permanent and irrevocable for 3, 5, or 7 years. Being thus independent, they will speak and decide without with becoming freedom.
Okay. All right. So, again, Mr. Dickinson then actually starts looking at this and kind of highlight at the very beginning. He says he considered it as essential that one branch of the legislature should be drawn immediately from the people, and as expedient that the other should be chosen by the legislature of the state. So this is starting to propagate. And so, again, we're just, you know, a week away from this actually gaining enough ground where I think Sherman was the one that convinced the smaller states to actually buy into this, to say, okay, you know, instead of it being solely controlled by the state governments, this is going to be divided. The legislative body would be divided between, you know, one representing the people and the other one representing the states. And we'll have to put in, you know, these. Well, we'll get into that when he covers that. Okay, so now Mr. Reed then goes this path, right? Go ahead.
Too much attachment is betrayed to the state governments. We must look beyond their continuance. A national government must soon of necessity swallow all of them up. They will soon be reduced to the mere office of electing the national Senate. He was against patching up the old federal system. He hoped the idea would be dismissed. It would be like putting new cloth on an old garment. The Confederation was founded on temporary principles. It cannot last. It cannot be amended. If we do not establish a good government on new principles, we must either go to ruin or have the work to do over again. The people at large are wrongly suspected of being averse to a general government. The aversion lies among interested men who possess their confidence.
Okay. Hmm. All right. Yes. Hmm. These men were not lightweights. I mean, these guys were pretty well read, and I'll just say, when you look at who they sent, these were not slack jaws. This was some of the best that the state had to throw. So without taking people out of office, at least not that I know of, some of them may have been in office at the time. I think Governor Randolph was, but maybe the governor's expendable. I don't know. Anyway, okay, so Mr. Pierce then adds to this. Go ahead.
Mr. Pierce was for an election by the people as to the first branch and by the states as to the second branch, by which means the citizens of the states would be represented both individually and collectively.
Okay, so it seems like it's gaining traction. It almost becomes a force of its own volition, if you know what I mean. It doesn't take long when something actually sounds like a really good idea for people to recognize, hey, that's a good idea. But the saddest thing that I've noticed in government is that bad ideas, regardless of how everybody agrees, that's just a bad idea. Bad ideas tend to grow legs and take a life on of their own. I'll give you a good case in point. Hillary Care, back in the 90s, was a very bad idea. It grew legs, it took a life of its own, and it became the Affordable Care Act a decade later. Anyway, now General Pinckney, basically, now again, he's from the South. So go ahead, let's see what he has to say.
General Pinckney wished to have a good national government and at the same time to leave a considerable share of power in the states. An election of either branch by the people, scattered as they are in many states, particularly in South Carolina, was totally impracticable. He differed from gentlemen who thought that a choice by the people would be a better guard against bad measures than by the legislatures. A majority of the people in South Carolina were notoriously for paper money as legal tender. The legislature had refused to make it a legal tender. The reason was that the latter had some sense of character and restrained by that consideration. The state legislatures also, he said, would be more jealous and more ready to thwart the national government if excluded from a participation in it. The idea of abolishing these legislatures would never go down.
Okay. Now, one of the things I'm going to throw in here is through the course of the convention, the Southern state delegates tend to expose themselves where they come across like these are hardcore, you know, slave-loving, racist people. But ultimately, towards the very end, they had to realize that they were up in Pennsylvania discussing this new government, that they would then have to go and take everything that, you know, the Constitution, whatever the outcome was, and hand it over to those people and then explain why they're getting that document the way it is. And so ultimately they end up coming out of the closet saying, look, we would, if it was up to us, we would give up slavery. But it's not up to us. We're the politicians. It is up to the affluent, the people that demand that they have slavery so that they can maintain their production levels in their agricultural fields so that they can do the things, because they can't get white people to work like that. So forth and so on. And I'm injecting some stuff here, but bottom line is, it becomes really revealing that these men are intellectual, but they have a they're disingenuous in the very beginning when they try to create a facade of how they argue against this and against that and so forth. And then finally, they just basically say, look, we're delegates from a state. We understand their paradigm. This is exactly what they want. We haven't even gotten into the wars and who funds the wars and all of that. That is coming. And that's all really good stuff. Because I was absolutely shocked the first time I read how the Southern states would basically say, yeah, we may have slavery, but we have the money that's going to help pay to fight the wars that you're going to have to fight to defend us. And think about that. In other words, the Southern states are in this union so that the Northern states can take up arms to defend their right to have slavery and, you know, their production and their affluence. That's just is wrong at so many different levels, right?
Oh, yeah. Many, many levels.
Yeah. So, And,
but it's easy for someone who's doing something evil or wicked or a sin to cast that on someone else.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
All right. So let's go into what Mr. Wilson now says. And Wilson from Pennsylvania.
Mr. Wilson would not have spoken again, but for what had fallen from Mr. Reed. Namely, that the idea of preserving the state's governments ought to be abandoned. He saw no incompatibility between national and state governments, provided the latter were strained to certain local purposes, nor any probability of their being devoured by the former. In all confederated systems, ancient and modern, the reverse had happened, the generality being destroyed gradually by the usurpation of the parts composing it. On the question for electing the first branch by the state legislatures, as moved by Mr. Pinckney, it was negatived. Massachusetts, no. Connecticut, aye. New York, no. New Jersey, aye. Pennsylvania, no. Delaware, no. Maryland, no. Virginia, no. North Carolina, no. South Carolina, aye. Georgia, no.
Okay, so that's 8-3. So now we have 11 states. Okay, so, and that's interesting how, as I'm reading this, Mr. Wilson basically thinks that it's okay to allow the state government to become administrative, because he says that allowing the failing of republics, as he points out in his queue of his history, he points that the failing of republics come from the states basically wanting to take back their power, where not, you know, the federal government by, you know, consuming more and more and more. And so it seems like he's kind of okay with this idea of reducing state governments into administrative roles. So, okay, so Mr. Wilson then speaks again.
Mr. Wilson moved to reconsider the vote, excluding the judiciary from a share in the revision of the laws, and to add after national executive the words, with a convenient number of the national judiciary, remarking the expediency of reinforcing the executive with the influence of that department.
Okay, so interestingly enough, he throws that out there. Now, Madison then seconds the motion, which I find interesting. Let's go ahead, what Madison says.
Mr. Madison seconded the motion. He observed that the great difficulty in rendering the executive competent to its own defense arose from the nature of Republican government, which could not give an individual citizen that settled preeminence in the eyes of the rest, that weight of property, that personal interest against betraying the national interests, which appertained to a hereditary magistrate. In a republic, personal merit alone could be the ground of political exaltation, but it would rarely happen that this merit would be so preeminent as to produce universal acquiescence. The executive magistrate would be envied and assailed by disappointed competitors. His firmness, therefore, would need support. He would not possess those great emoluments from his station, nor that permanent stake in the public interest, which would place him out of the reach of foreign corruption. He would stand in need, therefore, of being controlled as well as supported. An association of the judges in his revisionary function would both double the advantage and diminish the danger. It would also enable the judiciary department the better to defend itself against legislative encroachments. Two objections had been made. First, that the judges ought not to be subject to the bias which a participation in the making of the laws might give in the exposition of them. Secondly, that the judiciary department ought to be separate and distinct from other great departments. The first objection had some weight, but it was much diminished by reflecting that a small portion of the laws coming in question before a judge would be such wherein he had been consulted, that a small part of this proportion would be so ambiguous as to leave room for his prepossessions, and that but a few cases would probably arise in the life of a judge under such ambiguous passages. How much good, on the other hand, would proceed from the perspicuity, the conciseness, and the systematic character which the code of laws received from the judiciary talents? As to the second objection, it either had no weight or applied with equal weight to the executive and the judiciary revision of the laws. The maxim on which the objection was founded required a separation of the executive as well as of the judiciary from the legislature and from each other. There would, in truth, however, be no improper mixture of these indistinct powers in the present case. In England, whence the maxim itself had been drawn, the executive had an absolute negative on the laws, and the Supreme Tribunal of Justice, the House of Lords, formed one of the other branches of the legislature. In short, whether the object of the revisionary power was to restrain the legislature from encroaching on the other coordinate departments or on the rights of the people at large, or from passing laws unwise in their principle or incorrect in their form, the utility of annexing the wisdom and weight of the judiciary to the executive seemed incontestable.
Okay, so he's got a pretty sick vocabulary, doesn't he?
Yeah, he does get elaborate quite a bit.
Yeah, but he uses obviously words that you wouldn't think would be, you know, just, well, he was very well educated. Yeah, I mean, he uses a language that, you know, I think compared to how everybody else is speaking, he throws out some words that go, what? Anyway, they're not common even of their time. So that being said, now this kind of covers, and I highlighted this debate, folks, because this was the beginning, because unless you read this through and through one time, and this is a lot of 473 pages as I've consolidated all this. And so it's a book for somebody to sit down and read. And so the point is what I wanted to do was I wanted to grab these points in the convention where we saw the the evolutionary change of what the original idea was. Again, how Madison wanted to create this this government that would be controlled by the state legislature and give the advantage to the bigger states. And the little states said, no, we're not going to have anything to do with this. And so as it started evolving, first off, it evolved in the right mode to say, if we're going to have a national government, it's about time it started representing, especially if it's a Republican form of government, it should represent the people. In every nation in the world, a Republican form of government is one that is representative of the people. Now, that's it, though. They don't represent the other sovereigns or that sub-government. Never in the history of mankind did that county government have representation in the state government, or the state government have representation in that central or national government, like in Rome. You know, there was the Senate. The Senate was the state. That's it. And then there was Caesar. So this was a unique twist or turn that I think George Mason kind of assisted in, you know, pointing to this idea that actually started to grow in, I'll just say, one respect, consideration, and we're now at a point where it's not necessarily, you know, killed the original idea, but it did. I mean, in the idea of creating, what was that vote that they had before? That vote that they basically said that the question for electing the first branch by the state legislature, which was the original idea, it killed it. 8-3. In other words, the majority of the people saw and favored at the convention at this point in time that that would then be the people electing that. Now, the next step in the design was that this legislature, this lower house, would then vote for who was going to be the legislature or the representative in the upper house, the Senate, what we call the Senate. In other words, it wasn't the state legislature that had any say in this. It was this bottom house based on the original design. So this sets the stage for a week for this to percolate to where Sherman basically says, look, if we're going to have the people represented in the lower house, then we should have the government that they've created, that they've instituted at the lower level, at the state level, then the state legislature should actually be, you know, the appointers of the Senate and create this balance between the state government and the government of the people. Oh, interesting. Never done that before. Anyway, so we're kind of setting that stage, and where we need to go from here is, let me see here. We want to go down to Mr. Pinckney on June 7th, and there's a little series of comments where they kind of talk a little bit about, let me see here. They start talking about state legislatures and more developments regarding this. And this is where they start talking about the House of Lords and so forth. So in other words, the focus is now on the Senate, because it seems like the convention, the delegates in the convention, agreed that the people need to choose the representation. Now, we're going into break, so we will get back with Mr. Dickinson as soon as we come back, to where they can start chewing on this idea of how are, because now that the people are selecting the representatives in the lower house, now who's going to select, are they going to maintain that, the presented idea that the lower house would then elect both the Senate as well as choosing the president? Because that was the original plan. We'll be right back after this.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, process. This is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416.
Okay, so as we kind of look at what Mr. Dickinson, now they're chewing on this, the second part of the plan of the national legislature. So let's go ahead and start off with Mr. Dickinson.
Mr. Dickinson had two reasons for his motion. One, because the sense of the states would be better collected through their governments than immediately from the people at large. Two, because he wished the Senate to consist of the most distinguished characters, distinguished for their rank in life and their weight of property, and bearing as strong a likeness to the British House of Lords as possible. And he thought such characters more likely to be selected by the state legislatures than in any other mode. The greatness of the number was no objection with him. He hoped there would be 80 and twice 80 of them. If their numbers should be small, the popular branch could not be balanced by them. The legislature of a numerous people ought to be a numerous body.
Okay. Mr. Williamson, go ahead.
Mr. Williamson preferred a small number of senators, but wished that each state would have at least one. He suggested 25 as a convenient number. Different modes of representation in different branches will serve as a mutual check.
Okay, so, and there's a lot of interesting things that they end up putting into play regarding the federal legislature. And a lot of people kind of marginalize the sophistication, but we'll get into that as they start doing that. So go ahead. Mr. Butler was anxious to know the ratio of representation before he gave any opinion. Now, Mr. Wilson opines. Go ahead.
Mr. Wilson, if we are to establish a national government, that government ought to flow from the people at large. If one branch of it should be chosen by the legislatures and the other by the people, the two branches will rest on different foundations, and dissensions will naturally arise between them. He wished the Senate to be elected by the people as well as the other branch, and the people might be divided into proper districts for the purpose, and move to postpone the motion of Mr. Dickinson in order to take up one of that import.
Yeah, and you know, going through the debates, the ratification debates, Mr. Wilson really comes across like an advocate for more of a democracy. In other words, giving the people more control over government. Where, you know, when we were reading earlier, you know, how there were others in that convention that felt otherwise. Let's not give them any control. And so things are shaping up differently now, though. Okay, so now with that, Mr. Morris seconded him. So Mr. Reed then made it a comment. Let's go ahead.
Mr. Reed proposed that the Senate should be appointed by the executive magistrate out of a proper number of persons to be nominated by the individual legislatures. He said he thought it his duty to speak his mind frankly. Gentlemen, he hoped, would not be alarmed at the idea. Nothing short of this approach toward the proper model of government would answer the purpose, and he thought it best to come directly to the point at once. His proposition was not seconded nor supported.
So he went down in flame. Okay, so it flies in the face, because I know I get a lot of flack when I say this. When we look at the way the federal government goes, when you choose a new executive, but you don't let the executive choose his team, in other words, the Secretary of State, the Attorney General, you know, at the federal level, the president chooses all those people, correct?
Yes, sir.
Which, because he's running, you know, a campaign of these types of changes. And if you don't give him those types of controls to be able to, you know, appoint people that will support his plan, then haven't you just put somebody in there just for name only, and it's just a popularity contest, and you've not given them any ability to do what they said they wanted to do? That makes sense, right?
But isn't his job, I don't understand the thing of every new president has to have a new plan of, oh, I'm going to do this and I'm going to do that, when he has laid out exactly what his responsibilities are to execute the laws.
Correct. No, I agree.
What is this plan that he's bringing that he's going to do?
Okay, so if I was running for president, I would basically say that the entire Department of Justice is going to be retooled. That their focus is to go after every public servant that is failing to fulfill their oath of office. That we're cleaning up government this way. We're starting with government first. And then we're going to start.
Yeah, that's enforcing and executing the law.
Correct. So, in other words, if you don't let me choose the attorney general, if I'm fighting and the election, and basically I win the election, you know, by just, I barely get in, and the people have the ability to elect the attorney general, and they choose the opponent of my idea, they've just put me in a position where I can't win. I can't succeed. And my point is that when you want your government, because technically, when the president is pushing an agenda that's unconstitutional, he should be removed. He should be impeached. That's Congress's responsibility to do that. And so when you actually have somebody that, you know, because maybe everybody's happy with the way government is at this point in time, and that, you know, they don't see a big cleaning or anything like that. But if you sell the idea that we need to clean it all up, then you, if you don't enable, and the president doesn't have the ability to actually influence those people working for him. I'm not sure if you know, Andrew Johnson was impeached for basically firing, I forget who it was, in his administration. Now, technically, he has the power to, you know, reappoint somebody. But because the radical Republicans didn't like what he was doing, they went and impeached him. They didn't get him convicted. The Senate didn't convict him, but they still impeached him. They put him in front of a trial to basically say, hey, you know, we don't like the fact that you fired this guy that we thought was a good guy. Anyway, the point is that you don't want to create an executive branch that doesn't have, at least, I'm of the opinion that we're better off. If you're going to put that person in, give them what they need to either succeed or fail. In other words, give them the rope that they need so that they can succeed, or they'll hang themselves. That's my opinion. It's the same thing with judges. I don't think the judges should be lifetime, but I do believe that the executive should be able to actually ensure that the people sitting on the bench are going to actually enforce the laws that he's going to be enforcing. Especially if they're legitimate laws, you would think that the judge wouldn't do that. But look at today. Everybody has their own agenda, and nobody, and I mean nobody, is following the Constitution, and everybody's going in their own direction. If we looked and we actually were able to start replacing, I think that there's merit in this. Because really what we're looking at is, at the state level, we have almost a full democracy because everybody gets elected. And it becomes problematic if that doesn't make sense. If hopefully it does, because if you're not giving the executive the ability to build his team, then you know all you're doing is just putting a person in there and just, you know, giving them a bunch of resistance in doing what they want to do or what they should be doing or what have you. Anyway, anywho, I digress. I opened it up, and I'm okay with people not liking that. I think that there's a lot of people that like the ability to vote for their attorney generals and secretaries of state and auditors and the rest of these things. Me, I kind of like the Electoral College. I would much rather see the executive chosen by the Electoral College. Create a state Electoral College and then allow, you know, the people to choose their representatives. And then choose a representative that will choose the executive for them. There you go. We want to eliminate the idea of having direct campaigning. In other words, if you've got the governor that needs, You know, you got these men that are running their campaigns. You do understand, under the Electoral College, you do understand that we've got this issue that the electors run the campaigns where the candidate, the governor, he's really not running a campaign. He's just communicating to the electors. The campaign actually is the electors. We vote for the elector, not the candidate. They choose, and they actually run their campaign on saying, I'm voting for this person because of this. Or these are the two people I will vote for, depending on how things, you know, end up. But anyway, hopefully that makes sense. No? Sean, you there?
Yeah, I heard of the Electoral College, but I never understood what you're talking about, in that we're voting for the electors, and no mention is ever made of that. When you go to vote for president, it's put out everywhere that you're voting for president, not you're voting for these electors to select the president.
Ah, well, when we get into the ratification debates, that'll all be clear, because that's where they'll actually say that the people are to choose their electors. We're not to vote for the president. The ballot that we see will only have the names of our representatives, being the representative that goes into the district, the congressional district, the representative that goes into the House legislature, and the elector who will choose the president of the United States. So from the electors, once we, the people, choose the electors, then the electors are the ones that actually choose the president. So I know this is kind of confusing. Back in the days of the Constitution, it was unfathomable for an individual to run a campaign across all 13 states. They said, how can we even do this? How can we have a president that is kind of representing the people as a representative government? And they said, well, we have to create an electoral college. The Electoral College is the one that actually runs the campaign, and we, the people, vote for our elector. Based on the makeup of the Electoral College and the design and the way it was agreed upon, was that the people would get to choose their elector. That elector would be the equivalent person to their representative. In other words, on the fourth, you know, on every 4 years for the federal election of choosing the president, we would not only choose our congressional representative, we would also choose an elector. And that elector would be running a campaign over the course of the next, you know, the year or so building up to this, to explain to us who the candidates are. And there would be three, four electors that would ultimately start diving into who they would choose and why they would choose that person. For the most part, you'd find that some of the electors would all choose the exact same person, like George Washington. The real question was, who do you give the honor to that elector? Because the elector did not get compensation. The elector was an honorary position, and it was basically signaling that we trust you to cast our vote for the president. That's all that this person did. For a four-year period, his job was over just like that. That was my bad attempt of trying to snap my finger. So as I look at this concept of the Electoral College and how it was designed to simplify, to keep the cost down, because if the presidential candidates required a lot of money, they would be beholden to a lot of people or deep pockets. This was a beautiful system. It kept the, you know, them actually getting involved in running national campaigns. It kept them from actually having to go out and prostitute themselves for money. So what ended up happening, and we'll dive into this in the convention, and then we'll dive into it in the ratification base, because believe me, I point this out. And as a matter of fact, I pointed this out in Why Counties Matter Most. And I actually cited the different citations in the ratification debates where they literally said that the people will choose their electors to choosing the president. that it won't be a direct election or a democracy, because both of those things, direct elections, democracies, were pretty scary things to the people back then, if you know what I mean.
And now we know why.
So in the 2020 election, Bob Schultz contacted me because I'd been working with him. We did a petition to try to remove Inslee, and we tried to remove Durbin. And he did the petition. I kind of helped a little bit with that. And so we talked, and I started explaining to him the Electoral College. And he goes, that's interesting. And so he found out on Ballotpedia, and he came back to me, how the states violated the Electoral College Clause, because I kind of tuned him into this, that the only people that have the authority to determine how we choose our electors, in other words, the law that is passed of how the electors are to be chosen, can only be done by the state legislature. Well, what happened in 2020? Almost every state dismissed their legislators. And then the executive and or jurist or the secretary of states decided for the people, or made the decision for themselves, how we were going to choose our votes, cast our votes. They changed the manner of how we voted. And when it comes to the federal election for the president of the United States, that can only be done by state legislatures. So Bob got this. He goes, wow, this is huge. And he pointed out, and he pulled all the data together and created this petition. The only problem with the petition itself, and I kind of explained to him, you know, a day late and a dollar short, because it already got out, because he was in, you know, the urgency of the time dictated. And I said, it's really not that big of a deal. What you're asking for at least would cause pause and say, okay, you're right, but it's going in the wrong direction. You're pointing in the wrong direction. We need to point it back to the House. Because he wanted the election, or I should say the electors, or the states, to take it over, that the state legislature would then choose instead of the state electors. And I said, no, that's not how it works. It needs to go into the 12th. The 12th Amendment kicks in. If you don't have enough electors to choose the president, then the 12th Amendment kicks in just that fast. And what it means is that it goes into the House of Representatives, and each state votes by delegation. Each state gets one vote, and they choose the president. Now, the whole point of this petition, and we got this. Bob Schultz got this into their hands prior to January 6th, like January 2nd or 3rd, every congressman, he had a signed receipt that every congressman got this. And this is where he petitioned them to basically reject the electors, and to what he wanted to do was push it that way. It should have kicked into the 12th Amendment. But nevertheless, they should have rejected the electors, because he was right on that. And so had that happened, then what would have ultimately turned out is that the Trump would have been elected. Because when you look at the representation in Congress in 2021, as they were just seated on January 6th, the Republicans controlled 30 of the states in the state legislature, or in not in the state legislature, in the House of Representatives in Congress. So the only question would be, what about Cheney? Would Cheney have not voted for, you know, and because she already became a turncoat. I mean, Pence was a turncoat before he even put a coat on. So
got his gold.
So when we look at how it all went down, everybody knew that if they kicked in the 12th Amendment, the election that they just stole was over. Everything that they did would be gone. So they wanted to make sure that the 12th Amendment didn't kick in. And this is one of the reasons why they needed this distraction, so that they could then push off, you know, what they should have done and gone into, because that's when, remember, they actually ran from the chamber.
Yeah.
They didn't finish their duty, and then they did it under the shroud of secrecy. Yeah. And so bottom line, what should have ended up happening was the 12th Amendment should have been kicked in. Trump would have became president. And in the 2024 election, we would have probably been dealing with something completely different. Because I believe that because they didn't successfully steal the election, that we saved ourselves by the skin of our teeth, this SAVE Act that we talked about the other day would probably not even really be the fruit from the tree right now, if that makes sense. Because, we made it by. And now we're now going in 2024, heading down this path of trying, a new candidate, whoever that may be.
Yeah, it would have been President DeSantis. Do you keep up with what he's doing?
So
he already brought forth legislation and a plan to eradicate. He's going to do I'm not sure what it's called, but he's going to do a statewide vote on abolishing property tax. And then yesterday he brought out a plan to abolish H-1B visas at the universities in Florida.
Yeah. Yeah. And, I know that he's a strong conservative, and he's done some things that I kind of like. I just don't trust officers, military officers. I just don't trust them because they've learned politics in that vocation.
I get exactly what you mean.
Yeah, okay.
Exactly what you mean. Being an enlisted NCO, yeah.
Yes, and so when anybody comes to me and says, hey, well, how do you feel about this candidate? And he's a Republican, he's, got some great credentials. He's this former officer. I would never promote and support a former officer. They would have to prove to me that they're a champion for the Constitution, not a champion for, autocracy. Because everything goes their way. In other words, they're in charge, they want what they want, and this is what they're going to do, instead of actually being servant to the Constitution. So
I think DeSantis has a pretty good record since he's been in office. He hasn't been very autocratic. I mean, he speaks his mind.
Yeah, yeah. No. I'm okay with that.
Coalitions.
But I still see that, he doesn't speak enough. Like when it comes to the invaders, he's yet to really take the right position of deporting every invader that's in his state. I mean, I'd like to see people actually start taking the constitutional position instead of playing the political games of shipping your, invaders up to New York.
Yeah.
Okay.
I didn't like that either.
Okay. So,
I didn't like that at all.
So, I mean, like I say in the beginning of the show, it's about full compliance with the entire Constitution. And we can't be playing these political games. And so I'm not a DeSantis. I'm definitely not an Abbott fan. I'm not a fan of anybody that has a former military officer position, especially when they've made it up to colonel or an upper rank. I don't think that he made it. Did he make it to captain? I don't think so. I see Lieutenant DeSantis. I don't think he actually made it into the upper ranks.
I never
ranks.
Really followed his military background. The only good lieutenant that I ever worked with was one who was an NCO and then went to college and then came back and became an officer.
Yeah.
Greatest officer ever.
Yeah, so he was a lieutenant before serving as the legal advisor to the SEAL team, SEAL Team 1. And then I think he got out and then became a U.S. attorney and so forth and so on. So anyway.
That's sketchy.
Yeah.
The attorney for SEAL Team.
Yes. Okay. Yes.
Yeah, you weren't involved in any
legal advisor. Well, hold on. So at this point in time, our government had digressed to a point where, the commands required legal advisors because the politicians in D.C. demanded it. They had lawyers that literally said, yeah, you can do that. No, you can't do that. Instead of commanders making that decision. Right. He was one of those lawyers.
Right.
Okay. So right, wrong, or indifferent, I look at what we've got, and if they've been in the military and an officer, then anyway, let's get back to the content. Where did we leave off? We kind of left off with what Mr. Reed making his comment. So, yes. Mr. Madison, we got about 3 minutes, and this is doable. Let's see what Mr. Madison says.
Mr. Madison, if the motion of Mr. Dickinson should be agreed to, we must either depart from the doctrine of proportional representation or admit into the Senate a very large number of members. The first is inadmissible, being evidently unjust. The second is inexpedient. The use of the Senate is to consist in its proceeding with more coolness, with more system, and with more wisdom than the popular branch. Enlarge their number, and you communicate to them the vices which they are meant to correct. He differed from Mr. Dickinson, who thought that the additional number would give additional weight to the body. On the contrary, it appeared to him that their weight would be in an inverse ratio to their number. The example of the Roman tribunes was applicable. They lost their influence of power in proportion as their number was augmented. The reason seemed to be obvious. They were appointed to take care of the popular interests and pretensions at Rome, because the people, by reason of their numbers, could not act in concert, were liable to fall into factions among themselves and to become a prey to their aristocratic adversaries. The more the representatives of the people, therefore, were multiplied, the more they partook of the infirmities of their constituents. The more liable they became to be divided among themselves, either from their own indiscretions or the artifices of the opposite faction, and of course the less capable of fulfilling their trust. When the weight of a set of men depends merely on their personal characters, the greater the number, the greater the weight. When it depends on the degree of political authority lodged in them, the smaller the number, the greater the weight. These considerations might perhaps be combined in the intended Senate, but the latter was the material one.
Yeah, so let's look at it as currency. When you have more dollars in circulation and you put more dollars into somebody's pot, that doesn't mean that you've actually created greater value. But when there's less and you put less in, it actually creates a greater value, a greater perception.
Right.
And so, especially when it comes to the weight of the vote, it's interesting how, as Madison talks here, he's broaching on theory, because he's literally talking about, you know, the energy within politics, within legislative bodies, and these types of things. He's getting into the science of politics that very few, I mean, a few people do. They bring up the history and stuff. But Madison, at this point in time, was obtaining a reputation for probably being the one most prepared for a discourse, or I'll call it, you know, a debate. Into the matters of, you know, of all the topics at hand. He was always prepared with books and everything else, and he had a reputation that when he was going to get up and speak, he was going to cover the entirety of the issue. So when we come back, we'll finish this part off, the development of how they're going to form this upper body, because it is still an evolution. They've kind of settled on the lower body being apportioned and representative of the people. And so with that, folks, it's starting to take form. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless.
If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, process. This is what is referred to as Republic Review. Please read my argument for Republic Review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.